Hello and welcome to the Clock and Talk, an Arsenal podcast, and we're covering, for fuck's sake.
Good job, me and Schwinn are a lot more prepared than you, because if we came on and went, oh yeah, we didn't watch the game either, we was on the piss, it'd be a pretty shit podcast.
Well, Mesut Ozil is the best number 10 in the Premier League.
Yeah, that all looks good on paper, but there's never been a football match played on paper, so it's not really worth much.
I'm going to make a bold prediction that Jack Wilshere will sign for West Ham United.
It's time to start watching football with your eyes. I think people listen to what the commentator's saying and have that as their own opinion, but if you watch what's going on, you'll see things a lot clearer.
Schwinn, who do you think is going to win the Golden Boot?
I think Alexis Sanchez might do a number on that this year.
Okay. Tony talks about a clock being right twice a day. Tez is right every day. Right from five, lads. Fucking beauty!
Hello, and welcome to the Clock and Talk. I'm your host today, Schwinn. Tez won't be joining us today since we thought it's best for us to rotate him out, you know, considering Granit didn't start against Cardiff. Thought let's keep up with the template there and let Tez sit this one out. So I'm just joined by Tony. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I recognize you. You're from the Arsenal India podcast, right?
I've been on there a couple of times. It seems Darren and I enjoy chatting more so than you guys having me on. And, you know, after our quote-unquote fallout, Darren was very generous in accepting me and embracing me.
Yeah, well, someone's gone. I guess like a stray child, someone will always
Well, it's just me and you today, Tony, so we'll keep it short. There's a lot going on as we record. We're in the middle of transfer deadline day with a little under 10 hours to go. But it seems like Arsenal are done with their business, by all accounts. We'll talk about some of the more potentials that we're going to talk. But let's start with the things that have gone down for sure. And we'll start with Suarez. Now, Arsenal have confirmed that as of an hour and a half ago. Now, Emery also has made some comments. He said, we're very happy that Denis Suarez is joining us. He's a player we know well, and I have worked with him at Sevilla. He brings us quality and options in many different attacking positions, so he'll be able to help the team. Before we get into some of the more nitty-gritties of him, initial thoughts?
This isn't as much an indictment of him, but I don't think we have the players to play any system properly, and I don't think he adds to that because he's not an out-and-out 10. He's definitely not an out-and-out winger. I know he can play in these positions. Maybe as one of the three in midfield, like we saw the other day, we played 4-3-1-2. Maybe as one of them three, but that's not a position we're lacking in. I mean, the other day we had no Xhaka and no Ramsey, and we still managed to play that three in the middle. So this is nothing against Suarez, but I don't think he really adds to a lot of the problems we have. He may be an upgrade in quality, but I'd rather problems solved than things that aren't really a problem improved.
Yeah, you know, we put out a question thread, and of course there's some questions on Suarez, so let's quickly get into those because they'll probably take care of the rest of the conversation when it comes to him. You know, Sandeep, of course, asked on your thoughts. He also said that since it's a loan, it's going to be low risk, so that's a good thing. Cosman Buddha said the same thing. Maddie, however, asked a bit more, you know, tactical question. He asks, can you try to explain or envisage what Suarez brings to the team that we currently lack, or do you think it's more for squad depth?
See, I think this is my issue with it, is I don't think he brings anything we lack. Squad depth in terms of he probably comes into the first team and someone else drops out. But I don't see it as a major improvement. And it's not that he's a bad player, as I said. It's just it's adding things in positions we don't really need. As I said, he can play on the wing, but if he plays right wing, he's not the type of beat your man winger and get the ball into the box that we've all been calling for, especially if you've got Aubameyang playing up front. He's more that will join in and link in to the middle of the pitch and act like an extra centre midfielder, which is a system Emery likes to use. So I don't think, in answer to the question, I don't think he adds much, but he improves on what we're already doing.
Do you think he's someone who can help us progress the ball? I mean, from recent games, it seems the midfield and the attack seem a bit disjointed. You know, of course, we'll talk about the Cardiff game where I thought, other than Lacazette, who was, of course, having to drop deep, Aubameyang didn't get a whole lot on the ball. And I think to an extent that's because we don't have too many players who are able to connect the midfield to the attack. It will be someone we've relied on a lot to do that. Do you think he's someone who's going to come in and maybe challenge Iwobi either for the position or for that particular role?
See, it depends where he plays him, because if he comes in as, say, a replacement for Iwobi, Iwobi's been playing wide left, and Suarez is decent at progressive passing, but Iwobi drives us forward with more his running with the ball and his athleticism. Suarez isn't going to offer you that. If he plays in the middle, then, as I said, for me, I think I'd play him as one of the three. So if we're playing a back four, and the other day it was Elneny, Guendouzi and Ferreira, I think if you've got Suarez as one of them three, that's probably where he'd be utilised best. And as you said, with progressive passing, I don't think that system suits us massively, to be honest. But I think that's where Suarez would fit in best. And it's a system Emery's used since his Sevilla days. So it's obviously something he's happy with. But I just feel we struggle attacking-wise because it gives us no width. Or if we do use width, it's only via the full-backs, which then leaves us open on the counter. So, again, this is my issue with Denis Suarez. I don't think he fixes any weaknesses.
Yeah, it's really tough to say. I mean, the kid hasn't got a lot of playing time recently at Barcelona. And, of course, he showed some bright glimpses, you know, in his time at Sevilla and at Villarreal. But it's going to be interesting to see what eventually happens. Very abstractly, if you had to rate this transfer window, of course, he's been the only incoming, and we'll quickly get into some of the outgoings. But are you satisfied? It doesn't seem like we're going to do any more business this window.
I wouldn't be surprised if Nkunku comes in. But again, it's another signing that doesn't really overwhelm me. I don't think it's been a good window at all. We came into this window with massive holes in the team. During the window, we've had at least one, if not two, one really long-term injury, and one medium-length injury. And we've not... So we're coming with problems and injuries and not fixed any of them areas. The one player so far we have signed is someone who doesn't fix any of the problem areas, as I've just said. And I think even if Nkunku does come in, to be honest, not in terms of positions and where they can play, I see him and Denis Suarez as quite similar. Obviously, their attributes are different, but they can both play as like an eight or on the wing. It seems weird bringing them both in. I know both with loans option to buy, so they're almost like auditions. But it's like you're getting two players in to audition for one job when there's five other jobs that we actually need people for.
What does that tell you? I mean, in combination with, you know, with the fact that how strongly we're going for options, of course, that is driven to an extent by the uncertainty of Champions League. The fact that we're going for two players, having secured one, and they pretty much are going to battle for the same position. I mean, are these as band-aids can get?
I think with Nkunku, he's young, and look, I'm not going to say I've seen masses of him, but he's young, he's a utility player, he can cover a few different positions. I don't know how high his ceiling is, but if you're signing a youngster that's played that many games for PSG, you would hope that there is a high ceiling there. Whereas Suarez is, I don't know if there's much more improvement to be done with him. I think at Sevilla and Villarreal, where he's at his best, if you see that every week, then there's probably improvement in terms of transfer value. But I think he's probably reached his ceiling as a player. So I think that's probably the difference between the two, and probably why they're looking at them, as I said, if you see them as auditions, that's probably why they're looking at the two of them. But for me, that's the wrong way to go when you have holes elsewhere. If we didn't have any glaring problems elsewhere, I'd have no issue with what they're doing. But where we have, I mean, we're crying out for so many different positions, mainly an out winger and a centre-back, and we're not alleviating them fears or the players we are bringing in are not specialists. As I said, Nkunku and Suarez can both play on the wing, but I'm just bored of saying can play there. I want someone where you know this is where he plays, this is his job.
you know, almost like a core player, you know, someone who you can build a team around. But I think January is one time of the year when it's difficult to get those deals over the line. So
I don't even think you can build. I don't even think I'd say someone you can build a team around, because you're never going to build a team around a winger. But I don't think anyone ever really wins anything with or has a successful team with a load of can-do players. Like, say if you look at City, for example, and I know that they're streets ahead of us, but you look at their wingers, and it's 9 times out of 10 Sané and Sterling, or if not, it's Mahrez. They are wingers. They're not can-be wingers. They're wingers. And that's what we need. I know the quality's not going to be as good because the money's not as good, but Man City is obviously the prime example. But you can say that about a lot of teams. You know that their players are not makeshift players. I mean, look, we're above Chelsea currently as we record this podcast. Presumably, they're going to play Higuain at 9, Hazard wide on the left, which is where he plays. That's his position. Willian or Pedro on the right, they are wingers. They're not, he can be a winger sometimes, but... And that's what Arsenal seem to be dealing with. Everyone's like, oh, they can play there, but I want people who, that is their job. On their CV, it says winger, not centre midfielder, but if you need me, I can do a job out there.
No, I mean, I completely agree with you, and I think that's one of the main reasons I said a couple of weeks ago that the Suarez transfer doesn't quite excite me, because it seems like, you know, there's the square peg in the round hole and a versatile player, but not a specialist by any means. And I mean, having got this deal across the line, I am a bit more optimistic, because I think he's an addition and something is better than nothing. And of course, the fact that Sandeep and Kostin Buta, of course, later on, that it's low risk with an option to buy. We can always send him back. So it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. Let's move forward, because there's not a whole lot else we can talk about. We haven't seen much of the kid. But Emile Smith Rowe, he seems like he's on his way to Germany, or is in Germany at the moment, actually.
Yeah, I think he's having his medical as we speak. I really like Emil. I think he has a very high ceiling. And to be honest, I think he's not far off first team level at the moment. I think consistency is probably something that would hurt him. And you don't want to get that exposure, especially if you start playing bad. The last place you want to be is under the spotlight. Good move. Hopefully he gets game time out there. Obviously, with I think I said this on the podcast after the Tottenham game in December, that with Emery taking Europa League seriously and us being out of the Carabao Cup, a lot of them players, it's going to be the last time we see them. Actually, it was after the Blackpool game. After we beat Blackpool, that was going to be the last time that we saw Willock and Ketiar and I know Smith Rowe didn't play that day, he was injured, but them type of players, Medley. So I wouldn't be surprised to see quite a few loan deals, but I mean, this one in, one out, Suarez in, Smith Rowe out, yes, it's an improvement because Suarez is first team ready right now. And it's a good move for Smith Rowe, but I think we may leave ourselves short, especially, I know at the moment a deal's fallen through to loan out Eddie. I've jumped to the next topic here, but if we were willing to loan him out, we're literally playing a system at the moment with two up top and we actually only have two strikers, so it does seem a bit weird.
Yeah, I think that would be one that would leave us a bit short if we sent Eddie out on loan. You know, of course, it seems like Emery hasn't really favored him too much. I mean, he's got very little game time, even in some of the other tournaments. And of course, Danny Welbeck was someone who was available initially in the Carabao Cup, so he pulled rank. But now it would be wise to have someone like Eddie just waiting in the wings, just in case something happens to Lacazette or Aubameyang. Just before we move on to the Cardiff game, Perisic, Carrasco, players that we were linked with throughout the window. Ornstein, of course, came out today and said that we were much more forceful in the Perisic deal than the Carrasco deal, although we were linked to Carrasco, I think, pretty early in the window. Thoughts on that whole situation?
Look, Perisic has handed in a transfer request, and 99 times out of 100, when a player does that, there's no turning back, because he's essentially told them, I don't want to work for you anymore. And I'm sure in any normal person's job, if you tell your boss, I don't want to be here anymore, it's almost a footballing version of a resignation. Obviously, a footballer can't just resign, but handing in a formal transfer request is essentially as close to that as you're going to get. So it just makes me wonder how serious Arsenal were. Because once, as I said, once someone's essentially resigned or the equivalent of, it would seemingly be quite an easy deal to do. I mean, Arsenal apparently offered a loan fee with an option to buy. We don't know the figures. They also offered a penalty if we didn't take up that option. So say it was a 2 million fee to loan him and then an option to buy for 35, but then we give them X amount if we don't take up that option. Again, we don't know the figure. But, I mean, as I said, he was there to be taken. He wanted to come. Inter resigned to losing him. I'm not saying you have to pay through the roof, but again, transfer fees always lowered when her request is coming in, a transfer request, because as I said, they know he doesn't want to be there and he's not happy. So I don't really know how much of this was to build the fans up. I called it, I mean, with Perisic, I think I tweeted, if we look back for Twitter the day it was when it, and I know you would have seen it, we spoke about it in our WhatsApp group, that when, as soon as the news came out, it was the day after the United loss. And I said straight away, it's just to appease the fans. I don't think we was ever actually serious, and a lot of people will think I'm wrong. And I may be wrong, I don't know. But my impression as soon as that news broke was, he's not serious. It's just because we've had quite a bad loss the day before.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. I think it was maybe we wanted to get him in, and maybe there was an impulse to get in touch with Inter, see what his situation was. But I think it was born out of the fact that we suffered a defeat to United. I'm more surprised by the Carrasco stuff. I mean, I look, for Inter's perspective, I think it makes sense for them to monetize on Paris, especially the Premier League club interested. But I think the Carrasco deal is something we could have maybe thrown a bit more into. You know, he's, again, someone who's wanting to leave China. It seems like the club is willing to let him go. Of course, the obligation to buy was the stumbling block, but I feel like that, you know, with Raul's contacts in Spain with Atletico and the Wanda Group, I thought we could get this over the line. But when Ornstein tweeted that we were less forceful in that deal, that made me a bit concerned and a bit surprised as to why Raul didn't quite pull through with that deal.
Yeah, I mean, again, you've got to question how hard we actually went for him. Apparently, we made an inquiry in the first week of the window, and then we didn't go back until about 2 or 3 days ago. So, again, how serious were we, really? And how much was the going back to try and save face on it? I wouldn't be surprised. That I've not seen the offer, and I'm not trying to talk badly of the club, but I wouldn't be surprised if we tried to lowball absolutely everyone, offer them pathetic fees to take the players on loan, or the option we wanted to put in was for way below market value. And teams have just laughed us off the negotiating table. Because, again, both of them, Perisic and Carrasco, the deals were there to be done. If you wanted them, if you really wanted them, they could be got. I mean, I might be comparing us to some financial suits, superpowers in powerhouses, sorry, in Man United. But if United wanted either of them players under these conditions, I know they wanted Perisic a few years ago, it was different conditions. Under these conditions, United would have got it done. Liverpool would have got it done. I mean, look, you can't compare anyone to City because they'd have just offered what they wanted from the outset. But I just feel we've just spent so much time pissing about, and I'm not sure if we really were interested in anyone, to be honest.
Same old, same old. Anyway, I think it's time we move on to the game. Just quickly before that, Emily Ano Martinez, of course, left a week before the deadline day, which is today. He's joined Reading on loan, and of course his contract runs out, so we've probably seen the last of him in... I don't think he's anyone who's ever going to feature for us again. So there's that, just to round off all the transfers from this window.
Just to add with that, it leaves us another position that we're in dire need of in the summer, because Martinez looks like he's out the door. Cech's obviously gone. Matt Macey will never, ever, 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 ever be good enough. Plus, he's also 25. People seem to think he's some form of youngster. So that's... And Ospina, presumably, is off. So...
His contract runs out too, correct, in the summer?
I believe so, but I'm not sure if they put an extension in, because Napoli have got an option to purchase. And obviously, if his contract runs out, then they wouldn't need an option. So I'm not sure if they signed a year extension before he went, because otherwise that option's pointless for obvious reasons. So either way, presumably Ospina's going to be off. So you're going to have Leno, who's maybe your number one, maybe not. And then who? I don't even know who would be the name of the keeper that's on the bench. in that situation.
Do you imagine us going for someone really young with potential, or someone who's a veteran who can come and steady the boat a bit at, you know, in turbulent times and is a voice around the locker room?
Option B, I think. Because Leno's, 25, 26? In goalkeeping terms, he's still very young. And I think we'll go for a Lichtsteiner-type signing.
Yeah,
where a name we maybe have heard of, but he's at the end of his days and is happy to sit on the bench and fill in when needed, maybe play the cup competitions.
Cool. That's something we'll have to keep an eye out on. And, of course, as we get linked around and as we hear stuff, we'll talk about it on the podcast. Let's move on. There was a game we played a couple of days ago. Sleety weather, very cold, snowing, rain turning into snow and all sorts of things. Not a lot of attendance at the Emirates for this occasion. But let's go to the lineup. No Ainsley Maitland-Niles. He seemed to have picked up an injury. Elneny was in for Granit Xhaka. And Mesut Ozil back at captain at number 10. What were your initial thoughts on the lineup?
A lot to like about it. I mean, we assume Cardiff weren't going to come and try and attack us and go for the throat. So you could get away with Monreal at centre-back in a four, which is not something I'd usually like or advocate, but you can get away with it against Cardiff. Three defensive midfielders is never going to make sense to me against a team like Cardiff. I don't like it when we're playing a bigger team that can threaten us. So against a team where you're presuming they're not really going to come forward too much, I think it's lunacy. I think for me, as I've said this a billion times, if you're going to play that three, especially against one of the so-called smaller sides, Ramsey has to be one of them. For me, it's obvious, but it is what it is. Glad to see Lacazette and Aubameyang together, and yeah, good to see Mesut back. I think I was saying to the guy sitting next to me, if you don't play Ozil in that kind of game, you might as well just tell him to stay at home and pay him. Like, don't bother come training, just stay and play Fortnite or whatever. Just don't bother come in, because if you're not using him, then you're never going to use him.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think this was a game that, at least in terms of on paper, it was made for someone like Mesut, because you would imagine Cardiff were going to sit back and try and grind out a result, or at least wait for something, you know, that's level, at least the 60th, 70th minute, so that they have incentive to push bodies forward. But it seemed like from early on, maybe the first 10 minutes or so after, they were willing to push the envelope. I mean, I think it was Reed who got in a couple of times and had a decent chance, one from outside the box. He had a header which sailed above the crossbar. And on both occasions, it was Elneny who I thought was quote-unquote culprit. What did you make of his performance in general, and were you surprised that we rested Granit for the day?
I wasn't surprised that we rested Granit, because I think if you are gonna rest players, that was probably the game to do it. I was maybe a little bit surprised that both Aubameyang and Lacazette started. I'm not complaining about it, but as I said, if you're gonna rest players, for me, that would be the game. I mean, the header, I'm not sure if it was overly on any's fault, to be honest. The Reed shot, I feel. And then he got a little bit unlucky. He got a foot in, which is what you'd moan if he didn't do. And I'm not sure if it's Mustafi or Monreal came rushing out way more than they ever should do. The ball's looped over them and then Reed's in. And to be honest, I think he should have scored. I don't think Cardiff came with a plan to come and attack us, but we're just so loose and sloppy in our own half. I'm not even just saying our defence. I'm just going to round it up as in our own half. We're so loose. The chances are there. And I think teams, even when they don't come and try and win, that's not their game plan. Their game plan is to part of us and nick a goal. They think there's gaps here. We've got to exploit these. I mean, you look at Fulham. You've had Fulham come to us a couple of weeks ago. Under Ranieri, he's probably one of the most, I don't want to say negative, defensively minded managers in the league. And after 10 minutes, you could see they thought, hang on, we can have a go here. And they should have been 3-0 up. If they had better finishing, they'd have been 3-0 up. So I think it's just the way we're playing, and we're inviting teams to come and have a go rather than them actually thinking, oh, we can go and beat these today.
I tend to agree, and I think so does Sandeep and Vish. I mean, Sandeep said that we could have been 2-0 down to Cardiff, and if they weren't as clinical as any other top six team, then it would have been a tough job for us to go through. I mean, Lacazette had an early chance that somehow he just wasn't able to to convert, I think, in the first or the second minute, perhaps. But again, early in the first half, there's a shout for a penalty, and Lacazette, to his credit, stays on his feet. But shouldn't he really be going down there, though? I mean, Manga gets nothing on the ball, and if he goes down there, it's a penalty, right?
Well, before that, they should have had a penalty. So I'm going to show a non-bias here. It was a foul on Nias.
From Nacho Monreal?
Yeah. Luckily for him, I think because Kolasinac came across and barged him, the refs, he made the motion shoulder to shoulder. But before that, Nacho fouled him. I fought it from my seat in the ground, and having seen it again, I still think it's a penalty. I've seen a lot of people disagree with me, but if it was the other way around, we'd want it. So, but yeah, Lacazette's one. It's fair play to Lacazette. I was shouting dive, going to be honest. I don't mean as in he should dive or he should go down. It's not a dive, it's a foul. Fair play to him for staying on his feet. I guess it's traditionally what we should say is good sportsmanship. But no, fuck that, he should be going down. But the problem is with the referees or the linesmen. How have you not given that? Because just because he stayed up, it means it's not a foul. I criticise Salah all the time for going down like he's been shot, and Harry Kane for putting his feet together and arms stretched out like he's literally diving into a swimming pool. But apparently that's what it takes now. So I think in a way we should stop, because it's the referee's fault they're doing this. I think we should stop criticising Kane and Salah, because it shows that going down don't do you any, that staying up, sorry, doesn't do you any favours, and you have to exaggerate apparently.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think it's one of those situations where you have to make the most of, especially when it's as clear cut. You know, you could see Sol Bamba right after telling Manga that take it easy. You know, like we just got saved somehow. And of course, you know, there was another penalty shot, which we'll get to. But before we do that and we talk about the second half, something that troubled me a lot was Mustafi and Monreal. Now, look, Monreal has just come back from injury. And, you know, this is a makeshift defense. But I was quite surprised by how Nias, who, let's be honest, is not a top-level attacker, was able to get away and was able to run channels. I mean, were you surprised by how, and of course you mentioned that we were sloppy, but were you surprised by how much time and space Cardiff players were getting in our defensive half?
Well, not really, because I think this is the biggest flaw of the 4-3-1-2. Our width comes from the fullbacks, so Lichtsteiner and Kolasinac on the day are going to be slightly higher up. And the strikers, especially if they're half athletic, and Nias is, he's not the best footballer, but he is a good athlete. Well, they'll just spin into the channels, and Mustafi especially doesn't really want to be dragged out there. He will go out there, but if he makes a rash tackle and it kind of looks like your last man because the fullback's not there to save you. So, no, I'm not at all surprised, and I think it is the biggest drawback of the 4-3-1-2.
Well, halftime comes around, still 0-0, and we see Iwobi being introduced for...
Just on the second penalty shout for Lacazette.
Sure.
At the ground, it's literally the furthest point away from me on the pitch, so couldn't really see it. I watched the Sky Sports, like they do a 30-minute highlight package of the game, and I still wasn't sure. They didn't have a brilliant angle. I watched Match of the Day last night, because Match of the Day waited till all Premier League teams have paid, and I think it was a penalty. I don't think he meant to do it. I think it was Manga again. I don't think he meant to do it, but he stood on him, and for me it was a penalty.
Yeah, I'll have to agree with that. I mean, again, I haven't seen a good enough angle. I don't think there's been even one that's even made the rounds on Twitter. But I think when your back is towards the defender and you don't have visibility of what's happening... And when you go down like that, I think it's very instinctive. I think it happens because there was enough contact, because you're not trying to sell something based on what you're looking at. It's completely based on what your body has felt. And I think the way he went down was because his ankle from the back was stubbed. And I think that was a big enough reason. But, of course, referees have to be very sure. And
well, yeah, I was going to say, I can understand why he didn't give it. His angle, I mean, he had players running across him as well, Mike Dean, so he probably didn't see it. And it's hard, especially when a tackle, if you've not seen it properly and there's not been an actual tackle gone in, they're very hard to give. So, I mean, that one, I can kind of understand why he didn't give it, to be fair. Well, I think it was a penalty, but I won't criticise the ref for not giving it.
Well, he did give a penalty in the second half, and we'll talk about that, because there's a bit of you know, there's questions about that as well, even amongst Arsenal fans. But before we do that, at halftime, Elneny gets taken off. Iwobi comes in. We switch to a 4-2-3-1. And then shortly after, Jenkinson comes on for Lichtsteiner, who wasn't quite bemused by the substitution by the looks of it. Thoughts on those subs?
Yeah, I mean, Iwobi was our most attacking player on the bench. Well, him and Ramsey, you can argue who's more attacking. But so, and we wanted to change shape, so Iwobi was the obvious sub. Jenkinson was a weird one. Just sort of came out of nowhere. Didn't seem to be an injury. Don't know if Lichtsteiner's legs couldn't handle it. He was tired. I don't know. Maybe it's pre-planned. But it was a bit of a strange one.
Does that tell you something about Ainsley Maitland-Niles' injury? Do you think it was an attempt to, as you said, save Lichtsteiner because we don't want to be left with just Jenkinson as a right back?
Possibly. To be honest, I didn't think of that until you just said it. From what I've heard, Ainsley was left out with a bruised knee, which doesn't sound too serious and was more, we don't have to play him, so we're not going to. I mean, from reports I've read and whatnot, it seems like if absolutely necessary, Koscielny could have played, and the same with Ainsley. But again, if you can't rotate against Cardiff, then you might as well give up on being a squad game and just stick to playing 11-11. And if someone's injured, you only play 10, because that is the game, Cardiff at home, where you can rotate.
Well, we'll see. There's a couple of questions on that as well, which we'll get to. But let's get on to the penalty. Iwobi comes on and he looks bright. He's trying to do things. Lost the ball a couple of times, but that ball he played to Kolasinac was class, wasn't it? I mean, outside of the foot, Kolasinac is running at full tilt. Penalty for you?
Yes, but my initial, as it happened, I said he dived from my seat. As in, the leg was there, and if he would have ran into it, it would have been a foul. But I think he dived over the leg. But it's a foul either way. It's a penalty either way.
Elite penalty, though. I mean, you know, we'll talk about Aubameyang just in a sec, but not even for a second did he take his eyes off the goalkeeper. You know, Etheridge tried to delay a bit. And usually, you know, you're taught as a young footballer that don't look at the goalkeeper, look at the ball, decide before you're going to even take the run up that where you're going to hit it. But Aubameyang just stared Etheridge down and slotted the penalty at the very last moment, deciding, you know, depending on where Etheridge was going to go. And that's sort of what he brings for someone like you. Not the greatest performance, though, from him. I mean, I thought he was pretty anonymous in the first half and, you know, struggled with his touch in the second. What'd you make of him, his performance, you know, at the stadium?
Well, just to go on the penalty initially, I'm not being Billy Big Balls here, but when I play Saturday League football, I have always taken penalties like that because a keeper physically, unless they leap early or have a big telltale sign, they can't reach the corners. So if you just walk up to it and they don't make a telltale sign, they can't spring because they're not on their toes. So it's very easy to score. I mean, Hazard's been doing it for years. If you look at where his penalties actually go in, they tend to be shit. But the keeper's already gone the other way. And Arsenal, I've seen a lot of training videos of Arsenal players doing it. But then I think players are not always confident to do it in games. And I don't know if anyone watched the Tottenham v Chelsea shootout last week. Jorginho done it, and he done it earlier in the season against Huddersfield in the first game of the season. For me, it's the best way to take penalties. And interestingly, when I can't remember who they played. When Van Gaal, just before he went to Man United, he was obviously the Holland manager, and they went to penalties with someone, and he brought Tim Krul on in the last minute, and Krul is one of the keepers that stands. He does not move early, but he's fucking massive, and it spooks players out, but if the penalty is good, if it goes in the corner, there's nothing the keeper can do. So that way of taking penalties, I'm a big fan of it, but I know players who play in Championship, League 1, League 2, and they always say to me, like, they can't believe I do it because you literally walk up to the ball as well. So it looks so casual, and if you miss, you get hammered. And I think that's what it is. Obviously, I'm doing it in Saturday League football. No one gives a shit. We go down the pub after. But they're obviously doing it in front of thousands of people, and it's on TV, and you look like an idiot if they miss. So I think the technique is probably the best way of taking a penalty, but it takes a whole lot of bottle to do it.
It does. I mean, look, if you can deceive the goalkeeper but just by going by to the different side, then of course you have a high chance of making it. I think it's of course the pressure. What surprises me, since we're talking about penalties, is that people don't tend to go high up a whole lot. I mean, you talked about that Chelsea penalty shootout where I thought Azpilicueta hit a fantastic penalty into the roof of the net. Paul Pogba this weekend, again, you know, I feel a lot of times players tend to go, you know, just towards the ground instead of hitting one into the net, which is another thing I found surprising. You know, I feel like if you just power in a penalty decisively enough, I think that's also a good, you know, chance of converting the penalty.
I agree, but I mean, firstly, there's so much more margin for error when you go high. And also, barring a few, you may see them hit the roof of the net, but look at where they actually cross the line, and they tend, I mean, the Pogba one this week's a bad example because it's a fucking excellent penalty, but they tend to cross the line at what you would call a good height for a keeper. And Azpilicueta, I think the keeper went the wrong way. But again, if you look at actually where it crosses the line, they're not the best penalties. And then if you go any higher than that, you are playing with a real low. As I said, the margin for error gets a lot higher. Because obviously from 15 yards, I think you've probably only got a yard to play with if you're going properly high. I said anything that hits, I don't know what it's called, but where the joint of the back of the net hits the top of the net, obviously in the goal. If the ball hits there, it's probably crossed the goal line at head height, give or take, because obviously it's still rising.
Yeah.
So and that's probably a half decent height for a keeper.
A bit lower than head height,
actually. Probably nipple-ish height.
Yeah, sure. I would guess shoulders. So yeah, in that vicinity. But talk to me about Aubameyang's performance and what you make of, you know, him as a part of both systems and what do we need to do? I mean, look, he is a low touch player. I think we've all, you know, spoken about that. Even against United, he wasn't very very involved, but you know, popped up in the right place at the right time, and that's what he does. But against someone like Cardiff, I was a bit frustrated by him.
I think them games are probably harder for him in a sense. I know he scores more against them kind of teams, but I think because they tend to have more people in and around the box, it's harder for him to find that space. It's not, I mean, he missed a chance in like the 93rd minute or something, but it's not like he got chances and missed them. He just wasn't really involved in the game. I mean, he didn't play well at all. He wasn't involved. But for me, I don't think anyone played well I know we're going to get onto this as a man match, but I thought Ozil was the only player that turned up for the first hour, to be honest. And then after that, we got the goal and it opened up a little bit. And then Lacazette, I thought, was excellent for half hour. I thought he was pretty poor for the hour before that. Aubameyang was just not involved in the game, but we've come to expect that. And because we're playing, as you said, he's a low-touch player, but because we're playing, in brackets, a low-quality team, that doesn't mean he's going to have more touches because naturally they're going to have more defenders around the box, which is going to make it harder for him, not easier.
You spoke about Mesut Ozil there, and that's what I have next on here. Ramsey comes on for Ozil. Thoughts on his performance?
As I said, I thought while he was on the pitch, he was the best player by a distance. I know, look, he obviously didn't get an assist or he didn't create any magical chances, but everything we'd done went for him, even little flicks in our own half, or he played a reverse ball to Guendouzi that only went about 5 yards. It took out three midfielders, so it broke the line by playing the ball 5 yards. He also done a dummy in our own half to Elneny, which took out their whole midfield, but then Elneny turned backwards. Everything, I mean, he could have got an assist. He played a ball to Iwobi, and look, this was all Iwobi. Iwobi took the touch and dribbled through, and Etheridge made an exceptional save, to be honest. And there, if Iwobi scores that and Ozil gets his assist, I think people are lauding the performance. I'm not saying it was a 10 out of 10 because it wasn't, but I thought anything that looked like happening early on came through him. I think it was him that played Lacazette in for what would have been the first penalty if Lacazette went down.
Right.
I think, again, look, everyone knows I'm not a stats man, but I think while he was on the pitch, he covered something like the second or third most distance, had the most recoveries and the most key chances created. I saw figures like that banded around on Twitter.
He was also joint top in Arsenal players for tackles.
Yeah.
So that's another thing for the math lovers out there. I mean, look, I agree. I don't think it was his best game. But he's so crucial, especially in that system, in that position, as the player who links up, you know, three defensive midfielders, as was the case against Cardiff, and the two attackers. Now, look, I thought Guendouzi had a very good game. I thought he was heavily involved in everything, played some beautiful passes. I'm also, every time I watch him, I'm impressed by how vocal he is. You know, there was a situation where Cardiff had a free kick and Guendouzi was the one who cleared, but there was no one following him and he could have maybe put it into touch instead of giving it, heading it into for a corner. And he gave in to Leno at that point. But at the same time, Guendouzi is not going to be someone who you rely upon very heavily, especially when it comes to playing that final pass. So Mesut Ozil in those situations, I think, is very key, particularly in these games. I know there's games that are not perhaps meant for him at the moment, but it wasn't his best performance, but he's integral. And I think that was my takeaway. Not a 10-on-10, as you said, but 83rd minute, Lacazette scores a goal. Was that a 10-on-10 goal?
Just before we get to the Lacazette goal, I actually don't think that system suits Ozil. It gets him into his 10, but it puts two people above him. And as I said earlier, we struggled to get the width. Guendouzi, Torreira, and who's the other one? Elneny, or Xhaka, or whoever it is on the day, are never going to be ahead of them. So it makes it very hard for him to find these little intricate balls. And that's probably why his key passes, again, I've not seen the stats on this, his key passes were probably not too high. Because they've got four or five men in the box and they'll let you go wide. We don't really have width. There's going to be no real passes onto Lacazette and Aubameyang. I think you need to give someone like Ozil many options, not one or two. But yeah, that's my 2p worth.
No, I mean, just to echo that, I think that's one of the major reasons he was having to drop deep in the first half, especially when, you know, Cardiff were happy to sit back for a while. It was basically because of that. So I tend to agree with that. But yeah, go on and talk to me about the Lacazette goal.
Yeah, he had a shot just before where I think someone played a reverse ball into him. I can't remember how he got it, but it was on the edge of the area on our left. So, and it just seemed to open up for him and he bent the shot wide. Not a bad miss or anything. It just one of them things.
Again, that was just, sorry to interrupt, but that was because Mesut Ozil made a decoy run and he took two defenders with him.
Yeah, but their whole defence just seemed to open up. And then, obviously, when he's gone on to score, he's beat the first tackle from Bamba, which was a fucking crazy tackle considering where it was, because you're leaving yourself high and dry if you do get beat, which is what happened. And then again, it just seemed to open up. And fair play to Lacazette, because I don't think he's usually the type of player, or from what we've seen of him, just going to keep driving and keep driving and bust, like, to get into the box with the ball. Usually he'd look for a 1-2 or look to bounce off someone. So as after he's got away from Bamba, I'm in the crowd saying, keep going, keep going, keep going. And then, to be honest, he did that, and I didn't think the angle was the best. Nothing he can do. As I said, I'm shouting for him to keep driving, so I'm not criticising this. I didn't think the angle was the best, but if you hit it low and hard, and we all know he can hit the ball very hard, you give yourself half a chance. He's done all he can do. He's done very, very well there, to be fair.
No, he has. And, I mean, the celebration was pretty special anyway. I think he timed that slide to a T, somehow landed right at the touchline. So, kudos.
Everyone was going on about that on Twitter. And when I watched the Fulham game, I don't think it was when Chambers scored. I think it was when he was celebrating someone else's goal. He done a knee slide that landed exactly on the line as well. So I wonder if we practiced that in pre-season.
Thank you to Mr. Emery, I guess. We've not seen a whole lot of that before. But, you know, 10 minutes on, we're pretty much trying to see the game out at this point, and we can see the goal. And we have a question on that from AFC.PK. How can we not keep a clean sheet?
I mean, it's not... Yeah, you can concede one the goal sometimes, and Mendes Lang took his goal very well. But we was outnumbered at the back post, which is just fucking crazy. But we always do that. How many times you see us 1-0 up and the game's not done, and we leave ourselves short at the back because we're still trying to attack too much? It's madness. But it's Arsenal, and with Mendes Lang, to be fair, a few years ago, I was going to watch a friend play in League One. And they had someone on loan from Peterborough who Mendes Lang played for at the time. But Mendes Lang was also out on loan. And when we were checking the scores after the game, I was driving back home with him. And he said to me, I can't remember where Mendes Lang was, what club he was at. He said, how'd they do? Did Nathaniel score? And I checked and I was like, I don't think he did. And I was like, no, why? And he said, that kid can be absolutely anything he wants to be. He is easily Premier League level. I'm just not sure if he's got the motivation. And I mean, look, I'm not going to say he's clearly Premier League level on that, but it was a very well-taken goal. It's a great turn. I think it was a Iwobi sells himself too easy. Yeah. It's also a very good finish. And the kid is built like a brick shithouse.
Yeah, he's massive. I mean, he's very much like a Troy Deeney, but maybe even quicker. And
he's quicker.
Yeah, I think he took that goal very well. I mean, he left Leno no chance. I don't even think Leno was expecting a shot. I'm not sure whether he's left-footed, but he used the zip in the ground very well because...
Well, he used, I think it was Monreal, maybe completely wrong, but he used the defender very well. You know, I mean, I as soon as he hit it, I said good goal because as soon as it goes outside that defender, as I said, I think it was Monreal, it's in because keep can't see it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you see that all the time when players curl balls. They use the defender as a target to go round.
Hmm. No, it was definitely something that Leno couldn't have done much about. It's just that we've not kept many clean sheets this season. I think just the three, if I'm not mistaken. And that number is shockingly low. And against a team like Cardiff at home, you would imagine that you'd be able to do something about that. But that's a goal that, you know, you just have to put your hands up and appreciate.
I think it's another one where there's no major faults, but you're looking before that. I think Rules gets a flick around the corner. Kadeem Harris is standing on his own. He crosses it. They've got 2-on-1, arguably none at the back post. The ball comes out, Lang chops someone and sells them far too easy. So there's no big major mistake, but as a whole unit, there's so many mistakes in there.
That has been the case for most of the goals we've conceded this season, one could argue. Just before we move on to some more questions, man of the match, I have some who scored ratings pulled up. And
I've not looked at them.
So do you want to go first or do you want me to tell you who got it?
No, I'll go first with mine. As I said, I think Ozil was the best player while he was on the pitch, but Lacazette has had a game-winning performance. I think we've had this a few times this season where, do you know what I mean? If you win 1-0 and someone... I know we didn't, but if you win 1-0 and someone scores a goal and they played half decent, they probably deserve to win it. So I'd go Lacazette, but I think Ozil runs in very close. And it was quite interesting. I'm not sure if it was on us or on that AFC press account. They done a poll, and it was Ozil, Aubameyang, Lacazette, and... who's the other one? Whoever it was. And Lacazette won it, but people were going, why have you got Ozil in there? What are you on about? And I was thinking, why wouldn't you? Like, I think he got like 6% or something. But for me, as I said, I think it was Lacazette, but I think it was a close-run thing, and I'm seeing other people telling me Ozil was shit. Like, what?
Yeah, I don't think he was shit. I think it's we hold him to such a high regard that if he doesn't come up with an assist and still manages to have a bad performance, he's not in the conversation. And if he manages to have a good performance but not an assist, then he's shit. Who scored has Lacazette as well with an 8.0, and Mesut Ozil is at a 6.8. Guendouzi, Aubameyang, and Mustafi have all got higher ratings than Mesut Ozil. So, of course, who scored's formula doesn't agree with us on this. Because I tend to agree with you.
Who scored's formula agrees with whatever Aubameyang does.
That is true.
As we've said that so many times that... I think it's because every time he touches the ball, it has an impact, or percentage-wise, it's probably higher than anyone else's. So I don't know if that's how their algorithm works, but his performance... Look, I can't... I'm a big Aubameyang fan, as everyone knows. I can't look at that game and say he even played well. For me, that's a 6 out of 10.
I may be wrong on this, but it also seems like who scored has given Aubameyang an assist. No, that's actually correct. So I think the Lacazette goal, although it was completely on him, I think because Aubameyang played the pass to him, it registered as an assist for him. So that's probably another big factor that probably pushed him from, let's say, a 7 to a 7.4.
Well, that's what I'm saying. He could potentially have had 40 touches, I don't know. 40 touches, and he's had a goal, an assist, a shot on target, which the keeper had to make a good save, or at least a save. So if they do it something like how often has he impacted the game compared to how much he was in the game, you've got to go, 3 major moments from 40 touches. Yeah, that's amazing. But in reality, 40 touches against Cardiff or against anyone isn't really good enough.
No, it's not. Let's move on to some questions, unless you have something else to add on the game.
Hopefully we don't have another first half like that because it was fucking painful. But I feel like I'm saying that every week.
Well, you just basically answered that first question because Vish asks, how painful was that first half to watch last night?
I mean, I'm not sure if being there in the cold adds to this. It was fucking horrible. Like, your mind just wanders everywhere else because there's nothing going on the pitch. It's really uninspiring. The players look lost and you're freezing your bollocks off. I'm assuming it's the same for everyone watching at home except they're a bit warmer. But it was just painful. Just nothing happens, ever. I think at half time, they put the stats up on the screen. And it was zero shots on target from either side. One side had six shots off target, the other had four. But I think there was only three fouls or something stupid. And it was just like, I don't think there was the only booking at that. Oh no, there was two bookings, which was Monreal on the edge of the area and Patterson on the edge of our area. And you know, I've just watched 45 minutes of absolutely nothing. And I'm cold. Very cold. And there's no one in. Like, yes, painful.
I think many people decided based on that cold not to turn up at the Emirates the day before yesterday anyway.
I don't know. I've got a real problem with football attendances at the moment. I don't know what's going on. I don't like it. I mean, if you look at Tottenham yesterday, I'm not criticising Tottenham because it's the same with everyone at the moment, but 29,000 for a Premier League game, you can kind of call it a London derby if you want against Watford. Us, I mean, I'd be surprised if there was 30,000 at the Emirates the other day. I don't know what's going on, but I'm not fond of it. I think it takes away a lot from both watching it on TV and when you're there. I think it takes a lot away from the day. And I'm not sure about the Tottenham situation. With us, it was a sold-out game. You could not buy a ticket from Arsenal, regardless of what level member you were. So the tickets are sold and people have decided not to go, which for me is worse, because they're not only are they not going, they're denying the opportunity to go to people that actually might want to.
And to add to that, they're not giving clubs the incentive to look for alternative strategies. I mean, if the club is selling its tickets, it doesn't know on game day how much of the crowd is going to turn up, how many people are going to, you know, come through the turnstile. So
exactly. I mean, I obviously tweeted this last night, and I think he's your friend. I might not be wrong. Sid said it's the prices, and I was like, well, that game was the majority of seats on the ground were £26. And again, forget the fact that the tickets were sold out, but even if it was on prices, I think £26 is more than a fair enough price. I don't think it's too expensive. And also, the games that are sold out are the expensive ones. So I think people have got to stop using price as an excuse. I would love to know what the issue is. And I said I desperately think it needs fixing, but I don't think price is the answer.
Is it too many games? I mean, of course, the weather is a massive factor, and that's one no one can do anything about. But do you think if, you know, let's just assume there were just 18 teams in the Premier League, maybe a winter break was included, then people would have a bit more incentive to come for the games?
I don't think so, because I think football fans as a whole have got very snobbish. Like, oh, we'll go to Man United and Chelsea, which were both full, but we won't go to Cardiff and Huddersfield and whatnot. And look, even if you're an 18 team league, you're still going to have those teams flagging at the bottom, and people are still not going to turn up. Look, I kind of half expect it in Europa League, because until, well, you don't know when, but I mean, look at last year, I think Ostens is, I mean, the game at the tie was done as well at 3-0, but the ground was half empty, and then Milan, it was quite busy because it's AC Milan. So I think there's just a football snobbery going on, really. I expect Barté to be absolutely empty, depending on the first leg result, but I don't expect anyone to be there. But again, I can guarantee it'll be sold out. I already know it will be sold out. But there won't be anyone there.
Well, if there's someone listening to the show who did not go to the Cardiff game, then get in touch and tell us what the reason was. Whatever it might be, could be a very legitimate reason. Or maybe you just didn't feel like it. Either way, just get in touch and let us know. In the meantime, let's move on, because we have a question from Hakon. He asks, are we using Torreira to his strengths? There are a few things that I'm worried about regarding his role, tactics, and how we use him. If we can't set up the right way, he will not be the DM we need.
It's a strange one, because in this three, we play him. I think we spoke about this after the Chelsea game. Was you on that podcast, or was you still on your little hiatus?
I don't even remember. No, I was here. I was here for the Chelsea game. Yeah.
Yeah, so we spoke, obviously, he plays, when he's in the free, he plays as like a right centre mid. So it's basically asking him to do two jobs, because he has got a lot of energy. it worked perfectly against Chelsea. Genius. I don't know if you can do that job every week. And in fact, I'm almost certain you can't. And it gets him caught ahead of the ball a lot. It makes his positioning worse for obvious reasons. For me, I think the two worked perfectly with him and Xhaka early in the season. And it didn't give him too much responsibility. It didn't ask him to do too many things. I think in this role, while we have seen him play it perfectly against Chelsea, it somewhat clouds the mind about what he should be doing and where he should be standing. And I think he was a lot better in the second half when we rang Iwobi on and went 4-2-3-1. I think he has to play as part of the two, really. Or if you're going to play him as part of the three, he has to be that middle one that just sits. Elneny played it the other day. Xhaka played it against Chelsea. But I think if you want to get the best out of him as a defensive midfielder, he has to play in that role. But then, say you look at the Chelsea game, if he played there, there's absolutely no way Xhaka can play the role Torreira played. So again, it's kind of picking a team to the needs we have and not really where we should be playing them.
Yeah, I tend to agree. And I mean, usually I used to think that it's because we all know that Granit is not very good at receiving the ball with back towards the opposition's goal. And he's also not the most mobile. So if you're playing three midfielders, then Granit is best in that central role. And that was perhaps one of the reasons that Torreira was, you know, deployed as a right center mid, if that's what you call it. But against Cardiff, when Grant was not playing, you would imagine that Torreira was given the nod as that central point who is happy to sit back and let Elneny and Guendouzi do the running. But that still wasn't the case, which again surprises me. I mean, again, speaking of Chelsea, you know, N'Golo Kanté is someone who does a similar job, and he's also deployed on the right. But that's because it's clear that Sarri doesn't want to play without Jorginho. And we do rely on Granit a lot. But for the game that we're not, I was very surprised that he was not asked to fulfill that role.
Is that looking ahead to City, though? Do you want him playing as the deepest and then moving him out right? What is it, 4 days later?
It could be. It well could be, but I mean, Torreira is not a player who... I mean, I don't think you would be fearful of deploying him in a different position against just the one team when he's played that position, you know, throughout the season.
Well, he's never played in the middle of the three, has he?
No,
that's the issue.
In a 4-2-3-1, the two midfielders will usually take turns. I mean, I know Grant is the one who usually takes up that spot, but, you know, you share the responsibility to an extent, and in that system, you have players who will be a bit more cautious about moving forward, especially if the other one's already up there. So, I mean, I'd be comfortable with him doing it on paper, despite not having seen him there, wouldn't you?
No, I'd be very comfortable with it, but I think Emery's thinking is he's played this position every time we've played this formation. He's going to be playing this position going forward, so why move him out for one game where, in theory, we won't really need to do too much defending? I think that's the thinking behind it. I'm playing devil's advocate. I fully think he can play there. But I also see the logic in not breaking the habit if he's going to be playing there going forward, and that's where he's played in the past. Why change it?
True. Well, we'll have to wait and see how things progress, especially once Emery is able to get maybe a few more players in the summer and get his squad up together. Before I move on to the next question, just want to quickly apologize if you guys can hear disturbance behind me. There's a massive storm that's just hit Cape Town. So there's nothing I can do about it. I'm indoors and, you know, God's raining, so nothing I can do about that. Next few questions are on Lacazette, and they're a bit polarizing. I mean, we have someone like Matt Wyer saying that with less than 2 seasons of football in the Premier League, I feel we're only seeing 60 to 70% of Lacazette's full qualities. He says this is because his game's not based on speed. I think it's more to do with intelligence, fundamentals, movement, and timing. How much potential does he have for the next season? This season, he's added power and work rate to his game, for instance.
It's difficult to say because he's a million times better than he was last season. I think that's clear for everyone to see. He's a better player than he was at Lyon. A better footballer. He's obviously not a better goal scorer. I don't think we know where his limit is because, as I said, when you've improved that much, it's very hard to see where your ceiling is. I mean, he could add more goals, and in the last few weeks he has looked a lot more of a threat. I still maintain that he needs someone playing with him to be a goal threat. I don't think he's a threat when he's on his own. And the same can be said in another way of Aubameyang. Aubameyang's a threat when he's on his own, but we miss out on so much more. My worry is they're not going to be played together. And then I think either the build-up, if he drops Lacazette, the build-up play will be stifled. And if he drops Aubameyang, I don't think Lacazette will get the same number of goals as he's been getting. I think Lacazette needs someone to drag defenders away, and I think Aubameyang does need the same, but in a different way.
It's funny that you bring Aubameyang into the question, because the next question is from Utkarsh. He says that though Aubameyang has more goals, I'm starting to prefer Lacazette over Aubameyang in the middle. I think Lacazette is that kind of a player who will slowly and steadily get better with every season. And although Aubameyang has great utility, I think he's more suited as a sub when the opposition is tired. Your thoughts on that?
I think Arsenal are the only team in the world that could look at either the top scorer in the league or second top scorer. I don't know where exactly he is at the moment. And think he's an impact player that should be playing 20 minutes a week. Literally, it makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I don't think it's an either-or. I mean, we started the season with that sort of an approach, especially when we had a fully fit squad. But I think Emery has slowly but certainly recognized that this team needs goals from every avenue it can get, and with as much as time as it can get. So much so that even without a backup striker, we're willing to risk both of them at the same time. So I think even the manager is in accordance with you. The flip side to this is a question from Clay Co-Conservative, who says, am I off my meds if I believe Lacazette had a poor game had he not backed that goal? Thought his first half was piss poor, but a better second half.
Well, I think piss poor is probably a bit strong, but it's pretty much what I said earlier. I thought for 60 he was, I want to say non-existent, because he could have won two penalties. But I didn't think he was good at all. I don't think his hold-up was the level it usually is. I don't think his link-up in terms of his passing was as good as what we expect. I mean, I don't blame him for this, but that first Bobby Reed chance, the one where he, from outside the area that he put wide, came from Lacazette not holding the ball up. It was a horrible, I think it was a throw-in into him. It was a horrible ball into him, but I think I'd probably expect a little bit better from him there. So I'd agree. I thought he had an excellent 20 or 25 at the end, maybe when the game opened up. But for the first 60 or so, I don't think he really done anything. As I said, he was in them positions to be fouled for what should have been penalties, but none of them were really threatening. And had them tackles not gone in, I don't think he was going to do anything with it. So for me, as I said, I wouldn't say piss poor, but I think I've seen people saying, it's a 9 out of 10 performance. And I thought, maybe a 9 out of 10, 20 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing we can say, certainly, and look, people who listen to the show that know that we're not the biggest Lacazette fans here, but I think you have to give credit where it's due. I think he had a decent game, of course, against Cardiff. Didn't pull up any trees, but he made things work when they counted, you know. But I think one thing that needs to be mentioned is the improvement in his work rate, you know. There was obviously a lot of talk about how United were looking into him, but Mourinho didn't want to buy him because of lack of fitness, and he wasn't sure whether Lacazette's going to be able to, you know, play the full 90 week in, week out. I think we can put those debates to a bed now, because he's certainly proven that he's not going to abstain from working hard. And he showed that against Cardiff, and to his credit, he's shown that throughout the season. But Matt Dwyer 1 goes on to say that his hard work and passion are immense, and he had 72 touches, showed an enormous character. He was also vice-captain of Lyon. Do you think he's captain material for the Arsenal?
I mean, firstly, regular listeners, as I'm pretty sure Matt Dwyer is, he asks questions regularly, so I'm assuming he listens regularly. Well, no, I couldn't care less about the captain. I think the role went a hell of a long time ago. Does passion get the armband? Yeah, possibly. I mean, I'm never a fan of strikers being captain. Never have been, never will be. Because will it add anything to his game is what you've got to look at. I wouldn't be indifferent to him being captain, but this is coming from someone that I couldn't care less who's captain. At Arsenal and in general, I don't really see the need for a captain anymore. I think it's one of these things that was invented and it's now become tradition, and it's now an offence to not have someone with a captain's armband on. But I pretty much think that's the only reason it exists, because it's against the rules not to. Because I think for, and I've said this, been saying this the whole time since Clock End Talk started, that the role of a captain has gone long, long time ago. I mean, who's a proper captain? The last proper captain I can remember is John Terry, and he'd left Chelsea, what, 3-4 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of players around the league. Azpilicueta could be a good shout. He's someone, I mean, look, I don't know about his leadership traits and what he's like in the locker room, but he seems pretty steady across managers. It seems like he's been the universal choice, but is that because he's the only one?
Yeah, I'd have him more as a steady head. I mean, and wasn't Cahill captain until he couldn't get in the team? It's not like Terry went and Azpilicueta took over. So you look at Azpilicueta, and look, I think he's an excellent player, but he wasn't captain when Terry was there. He wasn't even vice captain. Terry's gone, Cahill becomes captain, so he's still not captain. So he was third in line. Like, in reality.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the role, as you said, of a captain in modern football is nowhere where it used to be back in the day, you know, where you had essentially the captain being a voice for the manager. You know, we saw that under George Graham.
Yeah.
With Tony Adams. And, you know, that continued, of course, under Arsene Wenger. But it's just not the same anymore. So I tend to agree. I mean, look, if there's going to be a captain and if you're going to talk about it, it's going to be Guendouzi for me, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the line. And as you said, I don't think Lacazette is necessarily going to benefit. You know, he might, but I don't think he needs that extra incentive just with the armband. Let's move on. And there's some general questions. I think we're done with... Oh, wait, there's one more. This is, again, from Clayco Conservative and MAA. They both asked this. Is it just us, or did everyone see Gunnersaurus vanish around the 60th minute?
Yeah, I think he quickly went in to have a little dinosaur pee and then never came out. And then Jenkinson came on. So read what you want into that.
I think this theory's been catching with people. Pretty sure.
I don't know if you saw it's a couple of months ago now, that Arsenal done a post saying you can ask us anything you want, but it can't be football related. And I tweeted, have you ever seen Jenkinson and Gunnersaurus in the same place? The amount of likes it got is a ridiculous question. It's unbelievable. I don't believe they put that question forward, though. We don't have an answer.
No, they're not going to divulge trade secrets on Twitter. That's not how we do it.
What a job. 65 grand a week to dress up as a dinosaur and let some penalties in. Living the life. I love it.
It's brilliant. On to some more serious stuff. This is from Maddie. Since all new players and Emery have experienced no holiday break for the first time, do you think that is a factor in the decline in intensity, fitness, form?
Wow, that storm's bad.
It's absolutely pouring down here. Wow, water's collecting outside too. Well, that puts a dent in my plans for today.
I don't know. I mean, the manager not having an international break, I don't think should make much difference. In terms of the players, who are we looking at? Italy's break isn't really a break anymore, but let's say Torreira. Guendouzi's playing much more football than he's ever played, so I don't think if he is tired, I don't think a winter break will have anything to do with it. And that's pretty much it, really. I think being a World Cup year will probably have more effect on the players. And to be honest, from now on, going out to United, we will have breaks because there's going to be FA Cup weekends where we're not playing. I think we've got Partey, we've got twice in a row because we've got no league game in between because we're out of the cup. So I think they'll be able to nick breaks. And Liverpool actually have been every time there's a cup weekend, they're going away for warm weather training. I think they were in Dubai before the Leicester game. They're going to Tenerife when the next FA Cup week is. I don't know if that's something Arsenal will be looking into, but it can play. That can be seen as your rest if indeed they do feel that the physical side of things is what's catching up with the players. I don't personally think it is because I don't think the players look tired. But if that is what they feel, then they can go and get some warm weather or they call it something climate training now, high climate training or whatever they call it.
It'll be interesting if we do that. I think it could help. I mean, we've seen Emery take the squad for a paintball game recently. And these activities help, you know, even in the corporate world.
Times are bad at Arsenal. Liverpool went to Dubai, we went paintballing.
But these things help. You know, these corporate retreats, excursions are needed to take the mind off stuff, and they help. And of course, players like Mesut Ozil, I'm sure, were happy to take aims at Emery because I noticed they were on different teams. Speaking of which, MAA Gunner has a question on Ozil. He says, I've been researching, and I found that Ozil has had this back injury for years, going back to his Madrid days. And it seems as if it's gotten worse over time to the point where sometimes he's missing a month of games. If true, why has a club given him this contract?
I thought it went back further than Madrid. I thought it was something he's pretty much always suffered from. How much does it keep you out, I think, is the question. Has he ever really missed a big game with it? No. I think when you want an excuse to rest him, that was given as a reason. And, I mean, recently, in time, it will go down as Ozil's been injured. He hasn't. Let's be honest. Let's not lie to ourselves. Emery didn't want to play him. He said as much. I mean, I've seen people saying, oh, tactical reasons could also mean injury. Well, no, because you just say injury. There's a word for that. It's injured. We don't have to dance around it. If he was injured, he would say he's injured. So I think it's one, again, it's another one of them injuries. If he wanted to play, he really could. But it gives them a nice excuse if they want to drop him and try to not cause headlines. The issue is with the way Ozil is, where it's so polarised, some fans are with him, some fans are against him, that for whatever reason you leave him out, there's always going to be headlines.
Yeah, it's clear that he suffers from back spasms. I don't think anyone can deny it, but you know, you could probably throw this question out when the contract was given to him, and more so during the Arsene Wenger time. But under Emery, it's pretty clear it's a managerial choice, not something that's forced upon him. But you know, there's not much we can do about it, and only time will tell what's going to happen. MAA Gunner goes on to ask, who's the best diver in the Premier League?
Harry Kane, probably, because it half looks convincing. I mean, Salah gets them, but it just looked ridiculous. I don't understand how refs give them, because it looks a joke, whereas Kane's little put your legs together and leap quite high in the air seems to work quite well.
Yeah, I think the refs have a soft spot for him, and I think aesthetically, as you're saying, he's a bit more convincing.
Salah's looked ridiculous because he puts his arms in the air.
Yeah. And just the way he goes to ground, he's flailing almost, as opposed to Kane, who's diving.
Like, yeah. Do you know when you see a tower block detonated and it collapses vertically?
Yeah.
That's literally how Salah goes down, but he puts his hands in the air as well. So it just looks ridiculous. Even sometimes when he is fouled, the way he goes down just looks, like, so stupid.
Yeah, no, I think Eden Hazard is someone who tends to do that as well. He's a bit more dramatic in his falls.
I think the thing is with Hazard, and I'm a fucking huge Eden Hazard fan, but for me, I think he takes the easy way out a lot. So, I mean, I know against us last year, for me, it's a dive in the area where he won a penalty. But in general, I think he takes the easy way out by getting a little touch, and rather than staying up and battling on, which he can do, and he does some good things when he can done that, as he showed against us a few years ago. But in general, I think he takes the easy way out and just goes down. But I think 9 times out of 10, I can think of very few times where I thought Eden Hazard completely dived there. And I think one of them was against us last year.
Yeah, I tend to agree. What about Zaha? Do you think he's someone who dives more than his fair share? I mean, he's come out and said a few times that he's targeted and refs need to protect him and, you know, other players around the league. What's your opinion on that?
I think he is targeted. I think that's clear. He goes down very softly. I think, look, you can call it a dive. It depends how you word it. If I was trying to defend him, I'd say he's anticipating contact or he goes over the leg, but there's no benefit. Like, for me, you've got to think sometimes, what is the benefit of staying on your feet? So if you have to jump over a leg that's on the floor, and you can easily do it, you have to jump over a leg that's on the floor, but then you're going to be running slower because obviously you're spending time in the air. You're going to struggle to get to that ball instead of getting it with ease. So what would have been a shooting chance is now you on the byline and you might not have anyone in support you can cross to. What is the benefit of staying on your feet there? And I think that's how a lot of players think when the leg is there and they put their leg into the defender's leg. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Zaha against us is probably a prime example with against Xhaka. What would have, he could have stayed on his feet. There's no two ways about it. He absolutely, if the floor was on fire, he could have stayed on his feet and not got burned. But what's the incentive?
Yeah, I mean, we spoke about it on the top of the show. I think refs have to be a bit more, I mean, I think there has to be a bit more film study done, and I think that's probably what they do during the summer when they have a bit more time and they review the full season. But, I mean, it is deception. I think it's very difficult to draw the line because of how subjective football can be. And, you know, you could see a replay 1,000 times and two people would still continue arguing whether the decision should have been gone one way or the other. But, I mean, I don't think players help themselves, particularly players like Mohamed Salah and Zaha. But there has to be a bit more. Will VAR help that, though? I mean, I guess that's the inevitable question because that's the only solution that's been touted around.
Yeah, I mean, look, for me, and I remember saying this last year when we were talking about Nias getting banned, and we spoke about it actually after that Chelsea game I just spoke about when Hazard dived, and I think Jack dived in that game and should have been sent off. The issue for me is the wording of the rule, because if they would have just left it as simulation, then you can still be touched and simulate. But now it's like either or. So like Salah against Newcastle, for me, that's a dive every day of the week and twice on Sunday. But there was a touch on his shoulder. You can't deny that. Even the most biased man in the world wouldn't see he was touched. So they're going, oh, he was touched. It's not a dive. Well, no, it can be both. You can simulate and be touched. And I think that's where they need to get back to. And interestingly, I think one of the only players that's ever been banned, I think there's two, but one of them was Nias for Everton away at Crystal Palace. He got a retrospective ban. And when they banned him, the statement they put out was, the force impacted on him was not enough for the reaction he gave.
Hmm.
If that was the rule, I would be absolutely delighted. But they seem to have gone away from that and made it either or. You're either touched or you're not, and it's either simulation or it's not. And I think that's the issue. They should have stuck with what they done the ass for. Whereas, so Salah would have been banned because, yes, you was touched, but you simulated. The force you were touched with didn't warrant the reaction you gave. And I think that's where the issue is.
Look, I mean, if the rules can be changed and, you know, obviously worded to be more reflective of what goes on, that'd be great. But I think a starting point can be retrospective bans, because I think too often players get away with it. When it's very clear.
There is retrospective bans, but the issue is they're giving them for absolute no contact is the only way they'll give a ban. And right. Nias was the one person that didn't get away with it. But even in the statement, they said he was touched. That's what I'm saying. The issue is that they've kind of gone away from what it was set out to be, and now the retrospective bans it. Firstly, you have to win a penalty. If you win a penalty and there was completely no contact, you'll get a 2-game ban. But as I said, what they've done the ass for is for me is how it should be. Yes, you was touched, but you conned the referee by going down like you'd been shot when really you had an arm on the shoulder. And that's when I was delighted when they banned him, not because I have anything against Everton or Cardiff. I mean, obviously Cardiff now on the ass. But I thought, yes, we're finally going in the right direction. Contact doesn't mean you're allowed to go down. Simulation still exists. But they've never done it since then. I think the only other player that's been banned for it is Lanzini. And I think it was a complete dive. I can't remember. So if there's any West Ham fans listening, don't come and shout at me. I can't remember. But they've just completely gone away from what they initially started doing.
Hmm. Well, that's another conundrum to this whole situation. I'm not sure how or when it's going to get fixed. Let's move on, because we've gone on for a little over, well, almost an hour 20 minutes at this point. This is from Cosman. Have any of you kept an eye on Callum's development at Fulham? Will he be an option for us?
Since Ranieri's come in, he's been playing in centre midfield, and every time I've seen him, which is not loads, he's looked like he's played very well. A lot of Fulham fans saying he's playing well. I don't think he'll come back to Arsenal as a player. I mean, as in he'll stay there full time. As in he'll come back from Fulham, and I think he will be sold. The issue is has he done enough to increase his transfer value, which I think was the idea of him going, and that remains to be seen. I think if they go down, it's not going to look good on him that he's had two loan moves and got relegated in both seasons. It'd be interesting, but from what I've seen, he's doing okay.
Will he be an option for us? Do you think he has room for someone like Callum?
Probably not, especially where they've Fulham have decided he's a centre midfielder. He's not getting in anywhere near our team in centre midfield. As a centre back, I mean, it depends who we sign and how long Holding's out for, but if he would have seen him as a centre back, I don't think he would have. I think he would have kept him and let Mavropanos go this season.
I think another factor could be if we make Champions League. I think apart from the money that we'll get, I think Europa League is something we could use him in as a centre back, but maybe not in the Champions League. And I think that could also be a big factor in deciding his future with us.
I don't think he'll be there regardless, to be honest.
Fair enough. Let's move on and talk about City. We have a few questions on that as well. Maddie asks, can we do a tactical analysis on what area and how we can exploit City, considering the available squad? I'll throw in a second part in here as well and ask you for a starting lineup.
The defensive situation's a mess for a start, so I don't know. I would probably say five at the back would work best, but I don't think we've got three centre-backs. I ain't got a clue. I don't even know where to start. I think he'll stay 4-3-1-2. But the one will be Ramsey. I don't know if Suarez is going to be in contention. If not, it'll be Xhaka, Torreira, Guendouzi. Kolasinac left back. Ainsley right back. Mustafi and Koscielny, I reckon. But I wouldn't be surprised if seven of them are wrong, to be honest. I think that's a case of where we're at this season, that formation and seven of the players I've named could be wrong. I think that's probably what he'll go with.
Yeah, I think Koscielny might be in contention. I don't think it's a broken jaw, which is good news. Socrates, of course, is going to be unavailable.
Oh, no, that's what I said, Mustafi. Yeah. I don't know if Socrates is in my head.
Ainsley Maitland-Niles. Let's assume for a second he's unavailable. Jenkinson or Lichtsteiner? Because that's what Sandeep wants to know.
Lichtsteiner, because I don't foresee much attacking. So you don't need... Lichtsteiner struggled to get up and down. But if he doesn't have to do that, then it doesn't really matter.
It's going to be a tough game. I mean, I'm looking through all these questions. We have a couple from MAA Gunner who says, how do we set up for Sunday, back seven or back eight? You know, Vish has gone in and said that despite being spanked by Newcastle, I mean, they're going to come out blazing guns against us. And he goes on to say, do we get five midfielders in as opposed to the four or the three that we've gone with usually? I mean, Brads, how many are City going to score against us? I think at least two before halftime, and Alba gets less than 10 touches on the ball. It's not looking very good, is it?
No, I think we've got to work the channels because they're going to push forward, obviously, from the fullback. So whether you leave Aubameyang on the shoulder and drop Lacazette in a little bit deeper and then spank long and get Aubameyang to run channels and hope Ramsey, this is why I think Ramsey will play, Ramsey and Lacazette have got the energy to get up and join him. And that way, I think you'll probably see Aubameyang having more touches than you're used to, but probably in areas where he's not used to.
Yeah,
to be honest, there has been games where I think Chelsea's probably a case in point where Aubameyang has run the channels and run really well. And play and done it well, but then it takes away a lot of what he's good at. But he will do a job for the team, but then he probably won't get in the goal scoring positions that he's used to. So I think it is a job he can do. And interestingly, I know we're talking about the way who scored rate and why he scored so well. I think that Chelsea game, where for me it's one of his better games, was one of the lowest I've seen all season he scored on who scored, because he had a lot of touches and probably low impact. Whereas he's usually high impact, low touch. So I'd imagine from him we will see a high touch, low impact game if he plays.
Is Mkhitaryan going to be back? I mean, look, he's been out for a while, so in all probability he won't play a role from the very start, and maybe not even a big role off the bench. But he could be someone who we could rely upon, especially with the lack in quality and depth we have. Do you think? Do you have any update on what's going on with him?
I have no idea if he's going to be fit, and even if he is, I wouldn't expect him to be involved. I think you'd have more chance of Suarez being involved, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. Finally, I had asked for some predictions for the game against City. Sandeep says he fears that we're going to get opened up and says, I think we're going to lose 3-0, but hoping we could win the game. Bended like Bentner came in with a prediction at 2-2. And Clay with the optimistic prediction with a 4-3 to the Arsenal. Give us a prediction today, Tony, since just the two of us.
Nope.
Oh, come on. I didn't ask you if you're going to give us a prediction. I said give us one.
10-0.
To the Arsenal or going to get spanked? Just 10-0. Well, this might be the day. This might be the time you're actually correct on this one. I know I went with a 1-1 against Cardiff, maybe because of that United result, but I'm going to be optimistic and I'm going to say 3-2 to the Arsenal. Let's see what comes of that.
You asked me to find you a drug dealer when you're in London. Have you found one?
Let's not talk about those things on air. Real live, we're recording at the moment.
Of course I'm joking, obviously. But if anyone knows anyone, at AFC Schwinn.
Yes, please get in touch. I will be looking for any paraphernalia that is available while I'm there. Well, especially with the way this season's going, I'm pretty sure you will be as well. That brings us to a wrap for today. Just before we go, since we have about 5 minutes, you know, we're in this season with Emery. First season, of course, a little more than half the season is done with. Europa League is going to start soon again. Any pointers that you want to bring up? Something to look forward to, or how do you think we're going to go about this season?
I'm looking forward to the weather getting better. Does that count?
To an extent, it might push some.
It's absolute nonsense.
Put some attendance numbers. That'll be for sure. But I mean, I guess what I was trying to get to was, you know, this Europa League versus Premier League. You know, we're fourth currently as we record, and of course that could change dramatically. We could fall to sixth by the end of this weekend. And I know with the Europa League, you know, we'll probably continue playing our strongest team in the Premier League till the time we have real opposition, but. You know, we don't have a lot of depth, and injuries is a real concern, especially, you know, when it comes to Aubameyang and Lacazette. I mean, would you be conservative if you were the manager? Would you rest them and only play them in key games when it comes to the Europa League, or you'd continue to gamble?
I think what you said at the start is correct. I think until the time we play a team that they see as potentially going to beat us over two legs, they'll continue to focus on the Premier League, and then there'll be a decision. Hopefully, it'll be sort of the end of March or mid March by the time that we need to make a decision. And you can look at where we are in the league and see if you have to try and prioritise both and drag the players through. If you can kind of sack one off or go a bit easy on one, I think you spoke about Lacazette and Aubameyang specifically. I think one of the two will play against Partey in the first leg and travel out there. And then obviously we'll see what our needs are in the second leg. As I said, we have no game in between. To be honest, as I said, if we do go down the warm weather route, I wouldn't be surprised if the whole squad goes out to Partey. But obviously they won't play a full team. But then if they go down to warm weather training, they can all fly from there. So everyone travels and you pick what you've got on the day. But yeah, hopefully it gets in mid-March and we come up against serious opposition in the Europa League and then we can readjust. If we're 6 points off the top four, then they'll probably sack off the league as we did last season. If we're still in contention, then there's some very, very tough decisions to be made.
Tough decisions indeed. Finally, it was announced that Arsenal's head groundsman, Reece Watson, has decided to leave the club after the Cardiff game. And, you know, he worked with the club for about 13 years, I think. So thank you to his service. You know, I mean, of course, groundsman is something we've been talking about, especially on our WhatsApp group yesterday. So we're happy that Reece was someone who served with dignity and was fair to even the visiting opposition.
So, yeah, just in case anyone doesn't know what you're talking about there, Liverpool are an absolute disgrace. Like, it actually really pissed me off. I hate them so much.
Like, tell the listeners what we're talking about.
But is there a word for, like, if you're racist against Scousers? Because I'm that.
Racist.
Yeah, but no, it's not. They're not a race, are they?
That's true.
But, like, so I don't know. If anyone doesn't know what we're talking about, it was snowing quite heavily in Liverpool and yesterday, and they played the first half, and the ball was holding up a lot. Every pass seemed like it was a yard or two short because it was holding up in the snow. At half time, the Liverpool groundsman cleared the half that they were attacking. So it's like a normal pitch, the ball ran smoothly, but left all the snow on the Leicester half, and it also it's still snowing, so there's more build-up. So when Leicester were passing the ball, in theory, it wasn't making its target, or not at the speed it should, so they couldn't break quickly, bearing in mind they were playing Jamie Vardy and Damari Gray, heavily based on pace, and then Chilwell overlapping. Like, it's just ridiculous. Like, and people are going, oh, it's home advantage. Well, okay, next week, dig half the pitch up at halftime. Make it, put hills everywhere. Put a fucking big mountain in front of the goal. Home advantage.
I don't think there is any excuse to this. I mean, there has to be some introspection from the FA into this, because it was as clear as day and night, the discrepancy between the two halves of the pitch. And still, somehow, despite a 1-1 that Leicester were able to grind out, Klopp manages to blame the snow, which was coincidentally not on his side of the pitch or the attacking side of his team. So, look, I think we all know what, you know, how desperate they are, and these are ploys to give them any advantage they could. As for us, look, you know, the Emirates is probably one of the best playing surfaces in the country, maybe arguably in Europe. And, you know, it's to credit our groundsman, you know, who's been with us for so long. So, on a happier note, thank you, Reese. Thank you for your service. And we know you listen to the podcast, so we'd love to have you on sometime and chat whatever you want to. Any last comments before we call this a show?
No. I guess, what is it? We'll be Monday recording, so I guess we'll probably have some potential misery on Monday. And let's hope we get someone else, anyone over the line today before the deadline ends. Even, do you know what? I think it brings a bit of a feel-good factor, even if it's someone you don't really know or care about, to be honest. Like, Nkunku's not going to set the world alight, but I think you just kind of feel a bit better if when you get a player in. I think you get a bigger lift if it's a Carrasco or Perisic, who you've heard of and you know is a top-class performer. But hopefully we get a bit of someone in. And I think it's quite interesting. I don't know if you've read the statement. When the Suarez statement, when it was announced, it said Arsenal completed their first loan signing of the window.
Interesting.
I mean, Arsenal's media team are known to be a bit simple, so it may just be just that they've been a bit simple. But hey, let's hold hope. What's life without hope?
Yeah, I mean, I'm you're talking to the right guy. I mean, I've been watching Sky Sports for the full, you know, ever since I woke up today, and they've really not been talking about anything. I mean, Newcastle have just signed Miguel Almiron, who, you know, we were linked with pretty heavily. But he's end up joining the tune. Apart from that, there's really been nothing that's been going on today. I mean, there's been some talk with Chelsea and Willian leaving, but that doesn't seem to be the case. So, I mean, I'm holding out for something towards the end of the window. There's still about 8 hours and 20 minutes left till deadline day ends. I wouldn't put my money on signing anyone, but look, I'd be very happy to be proven wrong, as I was with Denis Suarez. So,
also, let's see what happens. Obviously, it's rumoured that the deal with Eddie and Augsburg fell through. And I'm sure you're watching Sky Sports as well. They've signed Reece Oxford on loan. So I don't know if it's a case of they're only allowed a certain amount of loan players and they decided he was more important, or if Arsenal have pulled the Eddie deal because we couldn't get someone in. So it's not necessarily the second option. So that doesn't mean it's all doom and gloom, but I mean, it probably is.
True. All right, guys. We shall reconvene on Sunday. There'll be a question thread up. Monday. Yeah, there'll be a question thread up right after the game. And so leave us with your thoughts and comments on there. And maybe Tez will be back. Well, depending on if Gran is available or not. So thank you for listening. Thank you for downloading. You can follow us at clockend_talk. And we'll speak to you guys on Monday. Thanks, Tony. Take care.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.